Welcome to More Devotedly, a podcast for people who see the arts as a force for positive, progressive change. I'm Douglas Dietrich. I'm excited to tell you that even as we finish up Volume 1 of More Devotedly, Volume 2 is already taking shape. We've now confirmed that we'll be presenting our second live event as part of the Portland, Oregon Fertile Ground Festival on February 1st and 2nd. We'll be performing three pieces with poet and performer Laura Messersmith-Glavin, dancer and choreographer Stephanie McCullough, and Joe Kai on violin, who you met on episode 2. This show will offer a candid, emotional perspective, the perspective we usually don't take seriously, the perspective that we never trust when things get tough, on the theme of Volume 2, climate change. Until then, here's the next episode. In Volume 1 of More Devotedly, we're thinking about this question: who belongs here? When I lived in New York City from 2010 to 2013, I took a part-time job tutoring kids who were struggling in school. All of my students lived fairly close to where I lived, around 190th Street in the Bronx, in a mostly Black and Latino neighborhood. I took short bus rides up and down Webster Avenue to get to their apartment buildings, and when I got there, I did my best to teach them math and reading. Entering into these spaces, the homes of mostly poor, mostly immigrant families of color, was like a journey into a different universe for me. As a white person from the suburbs of Portland, Oregon, my entire experience of New York was defined by culture shock, but this job was a heightened, concentrated dose, and it sometimes left me feeling queasy and anxious. Though I was there to do something positive, I didn't feel at all up to the task. I didn't belong, and even my stomach knew it. Two of my students were twin siblings who lived in a public housing complex. One of them seemed to have an undiagnosed learning disability. I spent time with this first grader just counting and recognizing numbers. Her brother just seemed bored. Timing him with a stopwatch as he did his worksheets usually got him motivated. He used to make these cartoonish, fast noises with his mouth as he did the problems. But I never felt uncomfortable inside the apartments of my students. It was the coming and going that was hard. One day, as I took an elevator down from the twins' floor in the public housing building, a man who was riding down with his son warned me not to step in the puddle of urine on the floor. Because this building was at least 20 stories tall, the elevators were essential. Everyone had to use them every day, and I couldn't understand why someone would do this. But to this man and his son, the piss on the floor was just a fact of life. I remember thinking how glad I was to be leaving the building, and at the same time, I was sorry those twins had to stay. In a minute, you'll hear my conversation with cellist and composer Anna Fritz and actor Paul Soucy. They performed a play based on Homer's ancient epic called An Iliad in prisons across Oregon in 2018. They're remounting the play for another tour of performances right now in the fall of 2019, which you can learn more about at moredevotedly.com. Their audiences, men and women, who sleep every night in places worse than the housing projects in the Bronx, taught them something similar to what I learned about these kids and their families. That despite some really tough circumstances and deep systemic disadvantages, these were smart, kind people who have the same needs and the same dreams as everyone else. Just like everyone else, they deserve to have a safe place to live, equal opportunity to education and dignified work, and to have experience with the arts. For people who don't know it, the Bronx and places like it have reputations as terrible places to live. When President Trump tweeted about Baltimore as a disgusting place, he reinforced that stereotype. Yes, there are some serious problems there, but on the whole, the Bronx is an amazingly diverse and industrious place. I met so many incredible people there who taught me a lot about what it means to do good work, raise a family, and create vibrant communities. Most people think the same about prisons, that they're terrible places to be. Hell on earth, with bars and chains. And in a lot of ways, yes, that's true. It would be foolish and disrespectful to say otherwise. But even if the living conditions in a place are bad, the people who live there are not worthless. Of all the things I've learned through these experiences, this has been the most important. If we allow negative stereotypes about a place to form our opinions about the people who live there, it makes it easier to ignore the real problems that we could solve with a good faith legislative process. Artists have the power to spread positive ideas. Let's elevate artists who are doing that work. And one last thing. Through the whole interview, we never once talked about the crimes that these inmates may or may not have been guilty of. We also didn't really discuss the injustices that are built into the American justice system, and they are. What we began with was a more basic assumption, that no matter what they may have done, or what circumstances pushed them towards those acts and the punishments they received, they still belong. They are still human beings who deserve to experience the arts, and they can be trusted to deal with both the positive and the negative emotions that the arts can set free. They still belong, and they are still worthy of redemption. Here's our conversation.
I'm Anna Fritz. I am a cellist and singer and songwriter and composer. I wrote an original score for mostly solo cello and a tiny bit of voice, and played the role of the muses.
And I'm Paul Soucy. I am an actor and social work professional and an arts administrator and all these things. But for An Iliad, I played the role of the poet. And the play is an adaptation of Homer's Iliad. The adaptation is by Lisa Peterson and Dennis O'Hare. And we were directed by Patrick Walsh. And as Anna was saying, there's a role in the play that is scripted, but without any lines, that is called the Muses. And the poet, the one actor on stage the whole time, is responding to the Muses at various points throughout the play. And so for our production, we interpreted that as being a live person who composed and is performing the music on stage.
For people to visualize at home, it's just the two of you on stage. So, and we'll talk more about what it looked like, because that's really important. But Paul, could you talk more about your role specifically and kind of where it connects to the original text? And
sure. Other than naming the character the poet, there's not a lot that's explicitly said in the text about who this person is. The implication is that this is Homer. It could also be someone who survived that war, or who fought in that war, or was victimized by that war. The war being the Trojan War. And so this is a famous Greek epic where the war took 10 years and it was fought on a weird pretext, and a lot of people lost a lot of treasure and a lot of blood, and you know, and it's come to symbolize a lot of the cycles of rage and violence and trauma that Western civilization is built on. So it's a fun, happy script.
Fair. You guys performed this play in prisons all over Oregon.
We did, yeah. Yeah.
Can you tell us more about it, Anna?
Yeah, we performed at 11 different prisons. So that most of the tour was performances inside these institutions, although we also performed at a couple of schools and a homeless shelter, a halfway house, and we did two public performances. And actually, the performance you saw was at probably the most theatery space that we performed in. I mean, all the places that we were in were like cafeterias and weird conference rooms and classrooms. And and we're just spiking out, you know, a stage space for ourselves on the floor.
Yeah.
And going into the prisons in costume.
Right.
So in a lot of cases, they just thought we were a couple of weirdos. Like, why are they dressed like
this?
Which
is still true. I mean, we are a couple of weirdos.
For sure.
Can't really hide that. Yeah.
And to add to that, I remember that, Anna, you told me a bit about how you guys had to jump through a whole lot of hoops just to kind of enter those buildings, right? Could you talk just a bit about that? Because I think it'll become important later on in our discussion.
Well, so our director, Patrick Walsh, who did most of the organization and production of this whole thing, Patrick worked really hard to really have all our ducks in a row, to have a list of everything we were bringing in, that we sent photographs ahead of time.
And so that came down to costume pieces and like your cello.
The contents of my cello case, including some things that were sometimes not allowed in, like extra strings. So, yeah, it was a lot of hoops to jump through. And all of that preparation didn't always mean that they were really prepared for us.
Right. It was also like, it was this exercise, and it's like going to the airport, right? And you have to take off your shoes and take off your belt, and it feels really mundane, but also every little gesture, every little thing, you know, as you're going through that process, you feel the stakes. Like, if this wasn't on the inventory, they would tell us to, you know, get out of there, or there could be, you know, real legal repercussions. And they read out this thing that if you're taken hostage, et cetera, et cetera. These are the risks that could happen, you know, as an outsider.
And kind of being thoroughly dehumanized in the process, which is a really interesting way to enter your performance space.
So then once you do pass through those gates, talk to me a bit about these performances that you did.
Well, it's
so different.
It's very, very, it's a very different world. You know, there's uniforms everywhere. There are visual cues everywhere, right? So it's very structured. And you sense as you walk into these spaces and the audiences slowly assemble, you know, you sense that time feels different there. There were these beautiful murals in every cafeteria, in every performance space. There are these extraordinary murals of the outside world, of the environment, the wilderness around them, you know, mountains and rivers and oceans and forests. There's a curiosity there. There's a hunger there for something beyond what they're confined to, what they're literally confined to. And then once that bridge is built, it opens up dramatically. There is this immense vulnerability that they would bring to the material.
You know, normally when you perform, you know, you often have the advantage of a green room or, you know, a place to be where you're not sitting there staring at your audience waiting for the performance to start. And we had this, every place we went, they have to do these call outs where they gradually bring in folks from the different cell blocks that have signed up to come to the performance. And so we have this really weird time that sometimes lasted for like a half an hour or longer.
45 minutes,
where we're just kind of milling around nervously. And they're curious about what we're doing there and why we're dressed so weird and why there's a cello. And
and what is a cello?
For some, well, in some cases, what is a cello? Sure. In some cases, like at Two Rivers, I had a cluster of four cellists all around me wanting to talk about Jacqueline Dupre and, and... composers, you know.
Tell me about those four cellists. That's just, it's a really interesting image. I would love to hear just a little bit more about it. Like, what was that discussion like?
He made a beeline for me as soon as he came in. What I didn't expect was that he was like, oh yeah, that guy plays cello too, and so does that guy, and so does that guy. It actually just made me really nervous, because I'm like, I have all these cellists who are going to be scrutinizing my playing. The conversation afterwards was also so interesting, because they had a whole other level of insight about the music. But since this tour that we did last year, the cellists at Two Rivers have had a cello donated. So that was a remarkable effect of that whole thing.
Paul, there's something you said that I wanted to go back to. You were talking a bit about feedback from the audience. What did that look like? And was it different in any way than you maybe normally experience?
I trained as a Shakespearean actor which is ridiculous. and so I have a lot of experience with people just sort of glazing and like not even wanting to go there, you know, like the first five words and then they're just gone, right? And I know what that looks like and I know what that feels like as a performer on stage. And then you have to like earn their trust back and get them to pay attention again and wake them up and you know, all those things. But for this project, for these performances, in these really heightened environments that are really structured and really institutionalized, and as a person of color and a child of immigrants, like I'm really aware of my privileged status. You know, you have to leave your ID at the gate, and then what goes through my mind for like the next half hour is, what if they lose my ID? What if somebody accuses me of trying to escape from a prison and then they have no idea who I am and I don't have an, you know, like, what are my contingencies? What are, and, you know, you can go down that rabbit hole. And reading the room becomes a survival tactic. You know, are the corrections officers maneuvering to get a view of me? Can they see my visitor badge? You know, how is this line or how is this word impacting the guy who's crying in the third row? Or the guy who looks like he might be asleep in the back, but actually he's listening really intently. So those are all, that's sort of the nuts and bolts of this weird skill set. And it just, it costs a lot of energy. And, you know, Anna and I would like go out of these prisons really, really wiped out. And
yeah, spent.
I would imagine.
Utterly spent. Yeah, it was remarkable to me how present they were, how much they trusted us. And I know that, I mean, you and I both, when we perform, I mean, we gave everything we had time. I remember you saying something about naming how you felt the ancestors of the people present in the room with us. Like the folks in the room, all of us bringing all of our generational trauma as well as generational love and support and identity, and that all being really present in the room.
There's a part that of the play that makes me think of when you when you talk about that. There's the part where the poet is naming all of these horrors.
Yes. Yeah.
You know, I recognized those armed conflicts going very recently and back into ancient history.
Yes.
So, and all over the world as well.
Yeah, so. it's a 10-page sequence. that, you know, that starts with Sargon's invasion of Mesopotamia and goes all the way to present day, or as near to present day as when this play was written. And there's an ellipsis in the script where the playwright says, you know, try to keep this up to date, but you know, obviously don't go overboard, because 10 pages is even that is just the tip of a very, very big iceberg. And that is a really powerful moment in the play where I get lost, where my character gets lost, and I get lost, because it is sadly also repetitive and numbing. And
it's also the one part in the play where I'm totally improvising musically on the cello. For me, that is actually such an alive part of the performance, because I feel like I'm completely with you, responding to everything you're saying and feeling. And and it's a part of the play that has been deeply affecting, I think, to a lot of our audiences.
Right.
You mentioned coming to the prison as a person of color, as a child of immigrants.
Yes.
Did you see that reflected in the audience?
Yeah. You know, I would get a lot of questions like, are you Native American? Are you Hawaiian? Are you Samoan? A couple of folks guessed right that I'm the son of Filipino immigrants, but there's Chinese and Japanese in there, too. There was a fair amount of diversity. I think it's no secret that people of color are overrepresented in our prison system. Mm-hmm. But it's also a self-selecting group that comes to our show. So I don't think we saw a representative cohort of the prison population right now. I could see aspects of myself. I mean, I'm, how old am I? I'm 38 years old, and I, you know, and I recognize the look and the feel of folks who have been through a lot in their lives. Mm-hmm. And I recognize the look of addiction and the look of, you know, folks who have done things, right? And those are the parts of myself that I could see in there.
I was thinking about just how we usually think of artists and actors and musicians. Often we pity ourselves, but in reality, we're often quite privileged in that we can pursue this thing, and that we had parents who could pay for music lessons when we were growing up. And that's certainly not true for every artist, but it's true for a lot of us, and it's true for me. You represent somebody who's a little bit different than maybe most Shakespearean actors, at least traditionally. But then, Anna, I think as well for you, as a woman coming into a men's prison, how did that feel? I'm sure there was a feeling to that.
The first time I ever entered a prison was with a cello in costume going into our state's maximum security prison
in Oregon State. Oregon State Penitentiary.
So it was a hell of a way to kick things off. I definitely had some fear and anxiety going into that situation. And I think everything changed for me at the end of our first performance. Mm. Having had this experience of this piece of art with, and that audience was a large one. It was 150 maybe.
100, yeah.
Having that experience and moving into our first conversation with folks inside and feeling the reaction, the massive amount of appreciation and connection, I just felt all of my anxieties and fears and just totally melted. So, I mean, it continued to be a strange and uncomfortable thing to be a woman in those environments. But truly, the people that we were connecting with in those rooms, I felt so respected and loved and honored by when it came down to it.
You said at the public performance that I heard that it was a life-changing experience.
Yeah.
I think, you know, despite that stress and all the hoops that you guys had to jump through, you know, just to even be there, right? That you still felt it was a really important thing to do. Do you both see it that way, and why?
I think that doing work like this, that it could easily get spun as like we're coming in and doing a service. And it is. I mean, it's bringing something beautiful and meaningful to people who are denied beauty and meaningful connection in their day-to-day lives. But what I'm struck by is how deeply I was fed by the experience. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I told you it changed my life, and I guess what the crux of that is that I went into these institutions knowing that I was going to encounter regular human beings who are just like me. Mm-hmm. And I knew that intellectually, but I didn't really truly understand it until I had these experiences of giving myself totally in performance and then connecting with the humanity of the people in the room, walking out of the gates and having these huge doors slam shut behind us and realizing that these people who I connected with and who I care about and who I feel like I get and I understand and we're sharing this thing that they're going to sleep in a cage tonight. Mm. And it really drove home for me the reality of why folks in prison are so like out of sight, out of mind, because if we were really connecting with and really feeling the violence of incarcerating people in the way that we do, if we were actually feeling that, we wouldn't be able to do it. And so part of the work for me was feeling that over and over again.
Did you have a similar experience, Paul?
Yeah. I run homeless shelters for a living. I'm the manager of a 100-bed homeless shelter that just opened a week and a half ago.
I'll add a little note here. We're laughing because you're visibly tired.
Yeah.
That's why we're laughing.
Yeah, totally. Totally.
You're here doing this. That's why. So, sorry, please go on.
And I guess the reason why is because, you know, the whole thesis of my life is that, like, none of these things exist in a vacuum. That, you know, I'm a Portland native, and all my life it's like living in 9 different cities that are on top of each other but don't talk to each other and are invisible to each other. Mm. And you know, we say that Portland is so white. There are no people of color here. And there are. It's actually 1 in 3 in Multnomah County identify as a person of color. But we've trained ourselves not to see each other. We've trained ourselves not to hear each other. And this work in prisons is like the most extreme manifestation of that particular thing. Mm. And I believe that my life, my existence in this community isn't complete, isn't a true existence, unless I exist in all of these 9 different things at the same time. Mm. Which is very exhausting and terrible and unsustainable. but it's also like this expression of outrage that you know, theater shouldn't be this incredibly privileged and incredibly anodyne thing. You know, I think if we were touring My Fair Lady to a bunch of prisons, no offense to musical theater geeks, you know, if this was a really safe, you know, there's another interesting dynamic side note is that, like, I think the reason why An Iliad was able to tour is because it's to the corrections officer / administration who's making these decisions. They're able to say, oh, it's dead white guy theater. Right. So, you know,
It's totally safe.
I don't even have to read the script.
Yeah.
And because if they read the script with any attention, you know, I don't know that if they would have let us in.
Mm-hmm.
We sanitized it. Like, we had to take out all the curse words. But, you know, other than that, it goes to places that, you know, if you're a sex offender, or if you're you've been victimized or traumatized violently, then maybe this is not for you. I don't know. Like, and that's a whole other discussion about whether art should traumatize people. But
yeah,
you know,
which
but
we should definitely get to.
But you know, so I think that this work, it's powerful because it takes these risks. You know, I don't want to be doing anything other than this kind of work.
Let's talk about trauma.
Yeah.
Because we did that. So I think you both made it pretty clear that the work was very tiring. It was very taxing. It was very demanding and exhausting. Mm. I think you also made it pretty clear that it was very refreshing, that it was nourishing.
Yeah. Yeah.
In a way, too. Yeah. We should talk about the audience too, you know.
Yeah.
So these men in prison, you kind of mentioned that you felt that they were really in it with you, and I'm curious, what are the good parts of them having that experience? What are the bad parts? Mm. And are they better off?
So there's this thing in the county called the equity lens, where it's like 5 separate questions, and I can't remember all of the questions, but basically at every decision point, you question, like, how does this action traumatize or re-traumatize folks? What are the unintended consequences? Am I unintentional? Like, where are the sources of my unconscious bias? Am I unintentionally reinforcing some systemic trauma? So this is it's a lens that's supposed to be used on every major and every minor decision in the county and in social services work. I love it, and I struggle with it because it presumes that I, who am questioning myself, have the omnipotence of knowing what the unintended consequences are.
Yeah.
You know, yes, I've had diversity and equity training, but I can't see the future. And as an artist, the question is even more complicated because, you know, I want my work to be visceral and dangerous and taking risks and not just regurgitating the same thing that we've seen or heard a million times that has lost any emotional truth to it. But in order to do that, I have to be willing to go there and risk really having people be affected in a potentially negative way. And we had people who could. I mean, when in our public performances, we had people leave the room. Mm-hmm. We had folks who experienced real emotional trauma as a result of this work. Mm-hmm. And, you know, with due respect, I'm grateful that they allowed themselves to be that vulnerable. And I care about them and I hope that they're okay. And it's a really, it's just a complicated question to me. Like, what are my responsibilities as an artist after the fact to tend to or repair, restore the harm that may have occurred as a result of my work?
Well, and in the case of this project, it was crucial, in my opinion, that we had conversations with the audiences after the performances.
Right.
It was sometimes a little intense for us as performers to go immediately from this huge outpouring of performance work straight into like, okay, and
now let's talk about
it. But it was crucial. I feel like it really allowed the art to continue to work on us and also allowed for a real connection to be built too between us and the folks we're performing for.
Right. It definitely created this container for the folks who are seeing this work for the first time and feeling their feelings for the first time, for us to address that and to speak to that and try to build resource around that so that folks didn't feel isolated in that.
There were a couple of instances where we had talkbacks that were cut short or didn't get to happen. And there, I remember the federal prison that we performed at in Sheridan, where somebody had a work assignment they had to go to or something. And so the CO just decided, all right, we're all going now. And we'd only been talking for like less than 10 minutes.
Right.
I remember afterwards, I felt sick, like physically sick for days after that. And it felt like, like a lot of shit had been opened up and then not able to really get processed. And not that I claim that in our, you know, half hour or 45 minute talk back that we like tidily clean up any trauma that's been unearthed, you know.
Right.
But it is such a healing and an important part of the work that we're doing, I think.
Right. It's a gesture that was filled with that meaning of like, you know, no, we can't fix everything. We don't have answers for all of your questions. But we see it and we feel it too. And that recognition, that simple recognition that, you know, we're sharing the same reality with you, even as we're performing a different reality in front of you. I think that's part of the restoration of the thing.
Exactly.
That's what it's called, right? It's
the thing. Yeah.
Can you guys give us anything that you can remember from any of those conversations that stuck out?
I think on a regular basis about individual people that we connected with and that we encountered. I was pretty shocked at how many tears there were openly wept. And I remember a man in one audience saying that this had made him cry openly for his first time in prison. And he said, this is not a safe place to do that.
You're totally right that there's no way you could tidy up all of the trauma and the messes that you might have stirred up, you know, by performing, but starting that process and showing that you're willing to start that process, I mean, it sends an important message, I think, to the audience.
Right. Yeah, naming the thing, even if you can't heal the thing. And I think, you know, the vast majority of talkbacks that I've participated in the rest of my career have been really, like, I'm just rolling my eyes into the back of my head. Like, it's like, how did you remember all those lines?
Yeah.
And, you know, did you make your costume yourself? And, like, all these really silly, awful trash questions. And, but the questions we get in these talkbacks are so much more genuine, you know. And I think that that's related, not to get on a soapbox, but it's not, you know, these are guys who are not paying $80 a seat.
Right.
You know, they're not, they don't have their name on a plaque on the, yeah, on the armrest, and the lobby isn't named after their grandfather or something. Yeah. Right. So, you know, privilege, the privilege barriers are in this highly structured world that we go into, it's as though, for moments, we're able to take away the privilege barriers by virtue of meeting each other in this cultural space. There were trash questions, too.
Oh, also. Sure.
They were like, did you see the Brad Pitt movie?
And, you
know.
Yeah, sure.
Right.
Yeah, of course.
But also a lot of, like, a surprising amount of people sharing, like, intimately sharing about their personal experiences in ways that I didn't expect and felt honored by.
Yeah.
I wanted to have you guys talk a bit about if you learned anything from this experience about the idea of belonging.
Hmm.
How do these guys belong to each other, and how do they find belonging inside the walls? How are they going to find it when they leave? How are they going to find it with people on the outside as they're still in there?
It's making me reflect on how I had a sense in a lot of cases that the folks we encountered inside the prison still have very much of a sense of belonging to the community outside, and that part of what I was doing there was to say, yes, you still belong
You're
to
right.
us.
You were right the whole time.
You are still part of us. And one way that I feel like we continued to try to affirm that was in doing these public performances outside of the prisons, and really having a sense of knitting those rooms together. At one of our public performances, the one we did at St. David of Wales Church, there were two women that came up to me afterwards who identified themselves as the mother and grandmother of one of the guys that was in one of the prisons that we had performed at.
Right.
And we didn't even have to say much of anything. Mm. We just looked at each other and cried and then hugged, you know, that connection that was made from their son and grandson having this experience with us inside, and then us having that same experience with his family outside was really quite remarkable.
Yes.
And an affirmation of that, like, yeah, you still belong. You are still part of us.
Saying, hey, we did this at Oregon State Penitentiary, and just say those specific words and refer to that specific place. And, and you kind of created this opportunity where that could land in a much more significant way, you know, in their ears. As artists, like, if we want to encourage each other in doing work like this, and I think we should, you know, it's like, oh, I feel like we carry these people with us. And it's like, oh, well, that's beautiful. And that makes my spine tingle a little bit. And I get warm fuzzies with that. But at the same time, I'm like, well, but how would these
How other... does that really happen?
How does that happen? Yeah. And it's, I mean, I think that is also a function of this strange artifact that is Greek culture that continues to echo, where, you know, it's weird and it's fragmentary and it's mostly dead white guys. But there's bits and pieces of real resonant emotional truth that are constantly seated in all the things around our cultural lives now. And we're animated by these things that, like, I have no direct experience of the Trojan War 5,000 years ago. You know, but somehow it is a thing that can be alive. And then when we go through that work of recognizing what we have in common, where my lineage starts somewhere in this thing, and then you follow that lineage all the way to now, in that process of following the lineage, you're gathering all of these stories, all of these people into the room with you. And if we're doing our jobs right, the audience is doing that with us as well. And then we started making that conscious decision that every performance is in effect a jailbreak. Like we're taking everybody with us, whether you want to or not.
Yeah.
You know, you're going to be sitting through this play and your experience is going to be reflected towards these future audiences that we then meet. And vice versa, right? We now all exist out of time in the same way that the poet does.
That was a statement we heard over and over again in talkbacks, was that, you know, thanks for taking us out of here for a little while.
Mm.
Which I thought was interesting because there is so much trauma in the play. It's like, really, that was an escape?
Yeah, right, right.
Like, oh, man, what is it like in here?
Yeah.
Part that was most memorable to me was the list of wars, because I recognized some of them and there were so many that I didn't. The guy that you mentioned who just reacted really strongly to the fact that you just mentioned the one that he kind of identified with somehow.
You know?
And, you know, we don't know how or why that is.
Right.
Right. But what it made me think about was, so the work that you did, it's not efficient. Like in terms of
right,
nothing we do is efficient.
right.
So it's not efficient in terms of like time spent on the project,
right?
And like certainly in money earned, and certainly, and even in like just the hours that you spent in front of these prisoners, tons of times went into it, and then you got these moments, and you know, so there was just like this. Very inefficient, very, we could say wasteful. You guys were wasteful with your efforts.
Sure, yeah.
So, and of course, when I say it that way, I completely disagree with that.
Yeah,
I think
it's
not a waste.
Yeah.
But like, it's messy. It's not clean. And you will never know like how these guys really felt.
Yeah.
You know, that you'll know a little bit of the ones who told you.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And you could read a little bit, you could get a sense, but you don't really know. So often we think of incarcerated people as worthless, right? I don't think it's a stretch to say that. Given all the effort that you put into it and all the hoops that you had to jump through and all of the things that you've been telling me about it, why do it? Right.
Yeah.
I mean, like that's where we're getting here. It's like, why go through all that to create that experience?
Well, for me, it's because we're all one thing, because the human beings that we're throwing away in prisons are me. Like I actually have a very lived sense of that in my best moments. I mean, I feel like most of my songs that I write are breadcrumbs back to that understanding of oneness. And while we are separated in this way, and while we are causing this kind of profound suffering, I'm not okay. I am profoundly not okay. So it's that.
It goes back to what I said earlier. I mean, fundamentally, you know, I don't want to sound conceited, but I will.
Go for it.
I am, you know, I am paying my rent, is how I feel. Like, the only way for me to exist in this world and in this culture and in this country right now, and be able to sleep at night and be able to wake up in the morning and have any self-respect and pay my bills and have healthcare and, you know, make sure that I don't spiral into addiction myself is by doing the totality of what I am doing in my life. And, you know, that the clearest, most concise version of that is an Iliad. Like, I don't want to be doing work. I couldn't stomach the privilege that I enjoy if I wasn't doing this work. So it's kind of selfish, frankly. Mm. It's me atoning for all the shit that I can't do, to that I'm not responding to, or that I'm not healing, or I'm not addressing or redressing or restoring. You know, the Amazon is burning. Like, what am I doing about it? Well, I'm doing what I'm doing. So get off my case. Like, like essentially, I'm in a constant argument with my own conscience, and I think a lot of us are this world, right?
Sure, yeah, absolutely.
And so, you know, how do we get them, get your conscience to stop nagging you? Well, just don't sleep, I guess. I mean,
do something that matters.
Do something that matters. Yeah.
Yeah.
And
whatever's in your reach.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so in a way there's real power and safety in saying, I don't know what's going to happen in 10 years, to that guy who saw this thing and was really moved. And it's not for me to know. It's not for me that they are experiencing these things.
That's kind of the contradiction of it, I think.
Yes.
A bit is that we go there and we do these things because we think they're important.
Yes.
And yet you can't tell the person how to...
Exactly.
How to receive what you've given.
Yeah, it's a leap of faith, mm-hmm. of showing up for the work and doing it with everything you've got.
Right.
And mm-hmm. letting it go.
Right.
Thanks so much, Paul and Anna. To learn more about An Iliad and about the people who produced it, go to moredevotedly.com and check out the show notes. You can see pictures of my guests and links to a video of a performance created by Organ Live, along with a short interview with them about the play. You can also join the More Devotedly email list to hear about new episode releases and other news about the project. Be sure to join our Facebook group to respond to discussions about the show, and you can also follow us on Instagram at More Devotedly. And I know you hear this on every podcast you listen to, but be sure to rate and review the show on whatever platform you listen, especially on Apple Podcasts. It helps other folks find the show, and that helps me to make the show better and better. Thanks so much to Kim Gumbel for her indispensable help, and to Jenny for her support. I couldn't do it without you guys. I produced this episode and composed and performed the music right here in Portland, Oregon. To close out Volume 1, I'll be putting out a brief epilogue, sharing some ideas about the things I learned in the process of producing the first round of episodes, and about the idea of belonging. After that, we'll take a break to work on Volume 2, with the first episodes coming out in January. Probably. What you're doing is beautiful. Can you do it more devotedly?